podcast brought to you by the Triad Network. This podcast is designed to share trending topics occurring within the world and our communities and bring them a behavioral and mental health perspective.
Welcome to Behavioral Health Today, a Triad production. I'm your host, Dr. Graham Taylor, and today I'm joined by Kelly Burke. Kelly is a founder of Red Therapy Group, a group practice in the Nashville area. She is a licensed marriage and family therapist and certified emotionally focused therapist and supervisor. With over a decade of experience working with couples in private practice, intensives, and through local training. Kelly is a leader of the EFT Middle Tennessee community and mentors other EFT therapists as well. Kelly, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Graham. It's good to be here.
It's nice to have you. You know, just for our listeners, we're going to take a little bit different tact in our podcast today, and we're going to kind of talk shop as a couple of practitioners, Kelly and myself. And what I'm interested in is learning more about and sharing with you as our listeners, the patient population that Kelly works with, the EFT theoretical approach that she uses to guide her work, and how she understands the therapeutic process using this therapeutic approach with emotionally focused therapy. Also for our listeners, Kelly is hearing impaired. So I'd like to have some time near the end for her to share with us about how she manages this within the profession that involves talking. So Kelly, welcome again. I want to talk a little bit about your theoretical orientation being emotionally focused. Explain to our listeners about this approach and how you use it to organize the assessment of the patients you work with and also setting your treatment goals. Share that with us, would you?
Yeah. So I have an elevator speech because a lot of people, they know, okay, EFT, I need EFT, but what exactly is that? And so my clients come to me and they sort of need a little bit of a behind the curtain look at what EFT actually is. And so I say there's three components and they're always happening at the same time. And so with other models, you might hear about some of these components, but they won't necessarily be happening at the same time. And so the first one is EFT is experiential, meaning we're not just going to be talking about feelings. We're going to actually be feeling feelings in real time. The second one, it is attachment focused or bonding science. And so every bit of behavior, we're really looking through that lens that whatever's happening on the surface, there's a really good human reason for that. And so to really slow down and get clarity about what is driving this negative pattern or negative behavior. So it's a non-pathological approach. So experiential, attachment focused. And the third is obviously emotion focused. So we're following emotion. Emotion is like our North Star. Emotion gets us where we want to be. And so, you know, even if there's a more reactive emotion, as EFT therapists, we actually lean in instead of, oh, we got to make that stop or that's bad. Don't do that, because that's how we know that we're actually getting close. Yes. So reactive emotion, we're going to lean in, slow down, and then maybe get to some more of that primary emotion where you can really actually send a very clear signal. In my case with couples, to your partner.
Really good. That sounds great, but feelings are scary. We have a whole secondary consciousness that allows us to have defense mechanisms to protect us from those things that create anxiety and avoid these things. And maybe we have some things in our background, like you're saying, that make it really wise and maybe once upon a time survival based to not kind of lean in that direction. But you're saying I take my folks and I help them lean into the very things that might be really hard to be vulnerable around.
Well, and so of course you don't do it on your own, right? You know, there's fear of feeling. And so that's why it really takes a lot of safety and a lot of intentionality. And actually on the therapist part, a lot of actions, very active process. And so with my couples, I'm going to really be explicit about what I'm doing, and especially the more avoidant strategies. Sure. You know, they'll kind of look at me like, what is the point of this? Why would you want me to feel my sadness? That doesn't do any good. What's the point of that? And it is scary, you know? And so, but also there actually is a logical explanation for why we do this. It's not just to be in the feels, and it's not about catharsis. No. It's because emotion is meant to move us. And so if we're stuck, we've got to follow that emotion and kind of listen to it and give it space. And what is the function here? When you get that kind of clarity, it provides more safety. Like you're up here in your sort of secondary protective space.
Right.
And then the therapist says, let's go deep. And then you just go, no. There's a lot of scaffolding all the way down. Just safety.
I trust that safety is something that you allow to be in place that's going to build that trust that allows that leaning into the emotions to take place. You know, I want to go just a little bit more, and I want to find out in just a moment, how do you say when we can maintain a focus on these emotions, that's what moves us in a therapeutic and relational process you're describing. But I want to go back on something you're talking about, and we always know that in communication, there's two levels going on at one time. I think this is your second piece here around the attachment that you're talking about. There's content and there's process, and the process is the underlying piece. And more times than not, that's the unconscious part. There's something that's got us stuck. It could be explained by our pasts. It could be explained by maybe some traumas in our life, whatever it may be, but there's a reason behind it. And it sounds like one of the things you're doing is not only letting people maybe discover some of their feelings, maybe for the very first time, but it sounds like you're trying to create maybe a contextual understanding behind how some of these emotions, maybe the avoidance thereof, maybe some of the problems they're currently in, actually make sense.
Yes. Yeah. So we all make sense in context, but you're right. A lot of individuals or couples who are stuck in this protective pattern, they don't really understand their own reactivity, or they've made meaning of the stuckness that's not actually that accurate.
Yeah.
Because they're stuck. And so they haven't actually accessed those deeper, sort of slower emotions and experiences, internal experience within and between. So within a person and a relationship, both ways. And when you really slow that down and get really curious, that's where exactly that stuff that you're talking about kind of just spontaneously comes up. Like, oh my gosh, I felt this way when I was 5,
yeah.
You know, and it just sort of comes up because we follow emotion, and memory is laid down in emotion.
Yes, it is.
And so you follow it, and it tells you, it's actually not a cognitive sort of insight kind of prefrontal cortex thing. It's, you know, a lot of people want to think their way through
feelings
process, which is, that makes sense, right? It is scary to feel. And sometimes it doesn't make sense to that individual. But yeah, I've just learned to really trust to follow that emotion. And it just does. It takes us to those places that have not been processed.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what's driving the stuckness.
Isn't that interesting? The very thing that we are avoiding, probably for very good reason. You said there's a protective pattern here in one's communication or one's willingness to allow themselves to feel. Once upon a time, it could have made great sense not to feel these things. In fact, there's a meaning you're saying behind not feeling. You want me to do what? Feel? Come on. But you're saying that would be the very thing that once upon a time could be a threat, could not have been safe, whatever reason it may be. But what you're also saying is that the way that we once took care of ourselves and the meaning that we can give to that, and maybe even celebrate that was really good that you managed yourself that way. It's the very thing creating the challenge and the stuckness right now,
yes,
that you're trying to get people to lean through. Say more about that part.
Yeah. Sue Johnson says your protection becomes your prison.
Yeah, perfect.
And because, you know, what kept you alive when you were little and what made you, it is adaptive. It's not maladaptive. It's adaptive. It's genius. If you think about the way the body works, you know, you can't fire your parents, right?
Right.
So how are you going to make sense of what's happening? You're going to say, well, it must be my fault.
Yeah.
Well, then that becomes the way that you see yourself.
That's right.
And so I am bad. So now, yeah, like you're in an adult relationship and you're out in the world as there's something wrong with me. Well, that really gets in the way of intimacy. If there's something wrong with me, I got to hide. I have to hide this part of myself. Well, you know, partners pick up on that. There's something that I'm not getting. I don't have all of you. There's, you know, why is it that, you know, when I reach for you, it's like you're not there.
That's right.
And so it all really makes sense in context, but you're exactly right. What worked for us once upon a time actually ends up robbing us of what we need.
That prison idea that you're reminding us about is an interesting dimension. You're saying if I'm growing up in that manner and I'm also attaching to that, coupling to that, a belief about myself personally, a negative self-meaning belief, then I'm going to conduct myself typically unconsciously. This is not all conscious. This is unconscious, what you're encouraging here. Unconsciously, I'm conducting myself in such a way that I'm navigating through life in the best way that I know how. But that negative self-meaning also impacts the way that I present myself and make myself open to others' feedback relationally.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes people don't actually feel those blocks until they've really committed to be intimate.
Yes.
Though sometimes, you know, you won't really discover this. It doesn't necessarily happen when you're dating, let's say. You know, sometimes it's like after you've kind of, you're all in.
Yes.
And then it's like, oh, but then there's something happening. You want to be all in, but you sort of can't be because there's that part that hasn't really been engaged with in a safe way.
Yeah.
We call it disown part of self. So it shows up as a protective strategy and it doesn't work out that well in intimate relationship, but it could work really well in the work environment, mm-hmm. right? Or even with friendship, you know, it could actually be fine. It's just a matter of when you really want to get close, this is when it ends up being a block.
It's really a good point that disowned part of ourselves, it gets created in the context of our first family. So that's where the intimacy really lies. And outside of a first family or another family where that kind of intimacy occurs, our work, even our dating, it's not going to be exposed or surfaced in that point. It's only going to be surfaced once you say, I do, in whatever way you say it. That's when it's going to come up, because that object relations model that you had modeled for you now becomes the model you live from and work within in the relationship you're in that you've committed to fully. And that's like you're saying, that's when that disowned part really gets activated in a way that hasn't been activated before. And it only occurs within the context of intimate relationships. That's why people say sometimes, wait a minute, you weren't like this when we were dating.
Exactly.
Or we might even say to ourselves, I wasn't experiencing this when we were dating. Now that we've committed, now these things are surfacing. And that's what you're trying to bring to the forefront.
Yes. Well, and it's this attachment system, right? If you think of, you have like an attachment brain, you know, your caregivers, that's your attachment. Whatever happened there is obviously going to impact adult attachment. But people think that attachment ends at 18, right. And it doesn't. It's lifelong. It's developmental. But I do think that those attachment systems tend to get sort of reactivated when there's a time of need. But then what do we do with need? We don't need. That's kind of how we learned.
That's right.
Or we don't need in this specific way.
Right.
And so I find it happens a lot after couples have kids. You know, that's a real vulnerable time in a coupleship. It's like, this is hard. You know, I'm not sleeping. And so they end up doing this sort of tag team thing instead of really vulnerably opening up and kind of like, are you okay? Because I'm not.
Just naming it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And finding out they may not even be the only one. What you're talking here, I like, is this attachment system. And it gets, like we're talking about, laid down early in our most intimate relationships and resurfaces in our adult intimate relationship, typically with our partner, within our second family. But what greater place to see these things unfold than in couples? And you've shifted your work from doing hourly sessions and instead now are focused on doing primarily couples work. You've always done couples, but couples work primarily within the context of intensives. What led to this shift going into intensives primarily?
Well, I just like it better.
Okay, that's good. That's a good reason right there.
It's so rewarding. I will say not every couple is a candidate for an intensive. Mm-hmm. And so intensives, you know, the word kind of speaks for itself. They're very intense. The way that we format it is we have 3 days and it's really just one couple and one therapist, and you have a lot of space. Mm-hmm. So you're not so much worried about the hour and you kind of stay warm. Mm-hmm. You know, with weekly sessions, you're chit-chatting in the beginning, you're driving to and from work, you know, you've got childcare maybe, and there's a lot of sort of disruption before and after the session. And then it's kind of like, okay, switch gears so that I can function and do my life. And that's, you know, with couples who commit to weekly therapy and really commit to the process, they have a lot of success.
Yes, they do.
And there's a lot of research that shows, you know, EFT in that format, very, very successful. Intensive, there actually isn't research yet about this format, but anecdotally, a lot of EFT trainers are doing intensives. And so, you know, we just kind of feel that it works as well.
Yes.
And the thing that I like about it is you're able to get a lot of momentum because of that staying warm thing. There's something really special about sort of the intensive bubble. Couples that really benefit are the ones that really take time off of work and it's kind of treat it as like a getaway.
Yes.
It does attract a lot of couples in crisis. So sometimes that's not always the vibe, you know, it's not like a therapy vacation, if you will, right. But it really is so rewarding. And yeah, so we get that momentum. We're able to build kind of on the day before.
Yes.
And then at the end, it's kind of nice to look back and say, okay, you know, what have we done?
Yes.
And what are next steps? Follow-up work is really important. Yeah. For intensives, it's a great jump start.
I was going to say,
it's not a magic pill.
No, but I would imagine it'd be a great primer and a great jump start to going into couples therapy and maybe even on a weekly basis at that point.
Yeah.
Having done some really great foundational laying and actually experiencing the process in an intensive way, but with your guidance around it. Tell me, how do you set up this idea that here's how we're going to be emotionally focused and here's how we're going to start walking through it? Give us just a kind of a 10,000 foot view on that, would you?
Yes, yes. So I'm the longer I do this, the more explicit I am.
Good.
You know, I realize this is a collaborative process. And so it doesn't make any sense for me to be the wizard behind the curtain. And they help me, I help them.
Yeah.
And so I'm very, very explicit about what my plan is, what they can expect, and what EFT really means. And so one of the things that I'll tell them is I'll say, I'm going to interrupt you a lot. It's not because I don't care about what you're saying or I'm not interested or even that it's not important, but it's because I have to get you to a certain level of experiencing in order for you to get clarity and have some lasting change. Mm-hmm. So if you're just kind of telling stories and talking and sort of, we call it in content, it's not that it's not important. It's just that I need to interrupt you and slow it down so that you can send a more clear signal. So I let them know that I'm going to interrupt them because people don't like to be interrupted, right. But I let them know, you know, there's good reason for this. Sometimes I will share, do you know the experiencing scale, this body of research?
Give us a brief overview of that, please.
It's a body of research done in the late 60s. And a lot of models actually draw from this. They might have different language around it, but there are certain levels of experiencing. Level 3 is reactive. That's when it's kind of you're reacting to external stimulus. And so that's when I know, oh, we're close.
Yes.
And so I'm gonna lean in and slow down, and hopefully we can get to a level 4. Which is when you're associating within. And that's where we need to be for lasting change. So sometimes I will tell my couples this because I'll get questions like, do I need to cry? Like, what's the expectation here? Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with crying. Lots of people do cry when they're at a level 4, but it's unnecessary. You know, tears are not necessary. So, and it seems that when they have a good understanding of what to expect, they're willing to sort of just open up and let me lead them, and they will follow but they just need to understand the science behind it.
Yeah.
Where are we headed?
I can certainly see where that would make it feel even safe. Like there's a path here we're going down. that doesn't feel so kind of amorphous and kind of unknown and maybe secondarily kind of scary, but you're also not allowing them in the most therapeutic and benevolent of ways to not have the same conversation they always have and just do more of the same, expecting a different outcome. You are instead, it sounds like, intentionally shepherding them through so that that third part, the emotionally focused piece, it can be moved through down those stages and they can experience that with some corrective endings that maybe they haven't experienced before.
Yeah. We're looking for new conversations.
Yes.
You know, and so that's part of the interrupting. It's keeping it safe, number one. And I will tell couples, I don't think you want to do what you do at home with me. Right. You know, you can do that, but I really am going to be really active.
Yeah.
And then I also let them know we do things called enactments. Mm-hmm. And that's where I will kind of help one partner boil it down to maybe a nugget. And then after that partner has processed with me, I'll ask them to share with their partner. And those enactments, that eye contact and sharing sort of the heart of what's happening is really where change happens. And so, you know, couples at first will say, why would I just told you, she heard, he heard, why would I say it again? It's actually, so I'll set the stage for that, that there's bonding science that supports, and that's where we find the blocks too.
Yes.
You know, so
I love that. I like that idea where you get to, you know, do with them the within work first.
Yeah.
With you. And then they can do the between work between themselves after they have that understanding and maybe even gone a couple of practice laps with you to see that this is okay. And their partner being able to listen to it and witness it is not going to get defensive as much when that partner turns to the other partner and says, hey, here's what I want you to understand, because it's already been kind of played out and it's easier to receive. That's a cool process. We'll be right back after word from our sponsor.
Most of us spend more time at work than anywhere else doing anything else. So why not spend that time in a job you love? Introducing Triad's Jobs Marketplace, the only job site dedicated specifically to behavioral and mental health professionals. Featuring more than 1,000 open jobs from dozens of behavioral and mental health employers, and searchable by location, professional field, employment type, specialization, and more. Jobs Marketplace helps you find your next career opportunity. Full-time, part-time, or gig time, make the most of your time. To access Jobs Marketplace, register for your free professional account at hellotriad.com/BHT. That's hellotriad.com/BHT, and then click to Jobs Marketplace. If you're already a member of the Triad community, visit app.hellotriad.com/jobs. That's app.hellotriad.com/jobs. Visit us today and take your next career step tomorrow.
Yeah. And the therapist really is like a surrogate attachment figure.
Yes. You know,
because it's much safer to process with the therapist where there's really nothing at stake. And I mean, and that's part of the stuckness, right? They've tried this on their own a million times. Mm-hmm. And you know, so it's kind of having a safe other to explore.
Yeah.
And then, yes, let's try it between. And then we process that too, you know, so there's, what was it like to share? What was it like to hear? And that's where we find the blocks, and the blocks are good. That's what we need. We need to know about the blocks. That's good data.
Tell me some of the things you talk about in terms of blocks. What do you find tends to block us in being able to respond to our feelings and needs and maybe our partners when their feelings and needs are presented to us?
So many things. So I'm thinking of an example where, let's say, one partner gets pretty vulnerable about their experience in their interaction in the relationship, and they might share, they might even own something, right? Like, when you see me get defensive, what's really happening is I'm terrified of failing you. You know, such a beautiful enactment. And then you might get their partner go, what? No, that's not real. It's a completely new way of seeing their partner, and they can't take it in because there's been so much damage in that pattern in their relationship And so, of course, you can't take it in. The way you see your partner is angry at you.
Yes.
Right? That you're the problem. So when he's saying, yes, it's true, I get defensive and I'm owning this move that I make in our sort of dance, it's almost too much to take in. You know, another block could be an injury in the relationship. So, you know, when we get to vulnerability and we open up and share, you know, sometimes it takes them back to another vulnerable time where they were sort of dropped.
Yes.
And so it's really hard to take in vulnerability, even if it's a good thing.
Because it might be a very painful place. It's a very painful place.
But you weren't there. Why are you here now?
Right.
You know?
You know, just a little word around that. I like that acknowledgement right there. The idea that if, you know, that old saying, be careful what you ask for because you might get it. That right. idea that the things I'm going after and needing most, and I start to receive, I may not have the receptors for that, if you will, as much as I might want it and desire it. My whole life is built around trying to get that core need met. Once it's there and present to me, I may not know how to receive that. And I need to find a way to talk about how do I develop that? Because with those corrective emotional experiences that you're describing, my paradigm has to shift. And my openness to receiving these things, that someone that wants to love me in the way that I've never been loved or might meet my needs in the way that my needs have never been loved, that's new.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's hard.
It's very hard. It's very hard. And so, you know, we process those blocks in real time. And that's why those enactments are so important. That's how we find the blocks, right? Because it's like, even if it's a really clear, positive emotional signal being sent across.
Yeah.
And there's a kind of like a yellow light or red light. Good. Let's explore that. Let's get curious. And so then there's kind of an opportunity for the other partner to go into what's happening experientially. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully pass that back across. And so you're really working with the whole system.
Yeah. I was just going to say that. It sounds like you're as an emotionally focused therapist, very attuned, not just to their, you know, their family of origin issues or their issues around early memories and the context there, but holding the couple together, you know, kind of one in each hand, if you will, and holding and then working with one and then kind of coming back and holding the other and then trying to hold them together and point them towards one another. That's a lot of a choreographed set of actions there, isn't it?
It's a lot of moving parts. And when I train therapists and just supervise therapists and they ask me how to do this, if they have, and a lot of my supervisees do, if they have more than one child at home, I say, will you already do this? Right. You know, your kids come to you at the same time, both crying, right? So-and-so hit me. Well, she said, blah, 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 blah. And what do? You put your hands on both of them. That's right. Okay, guys, I can only talk to one of you at a time. Yeah. Slow down. I'm here. You'll get your turn in a minute. You know, you just with both of them at the same time. And that's kind of what we do in couples work.
That's really cool. I want to talk about it in your work, what you might see some of the tougher issues in couples work being. I want to hold that just for a quick second, though. Just a curious therapist question. Do you think in terms of selecting our life partner, do you think we get together with someone for a reason?
So there's a lot of controversy about that. I don't think that there's one answer there. I think it's sort of a personal frame that you might take. You know, if you were to ask Sue Johnson that question, she would say, it's just timing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, my limbic system is open, your limbic system is open, and we go. Other EFT trainers would say that, you know, you kind of meet your equal. And so sort of a level of trauma. I think for me, I choose not to think about it too much because if I have a couple in my office and they have the same goal for therapy, then that's all I need to know.
That's right.
You know, I'm not going to worry about should you be together. That's not my job. Yeah. My job is you want this relationship to work. And so I'm going to do the process like I know how to do. And whatever the outcome is, you know, that's really up to you. It's not up to me.
Mm-hmm. That's really good. The idea about what some of the tougher issues in therapy might be is you've worked with couples over this last decade and you're focused primarily now being in the intensives and really in the trenches with these folks that are coming in and being vulnerable with you, willing to invest, you know, time and money and their energy and their emotions in this process and their heart. What are some of the tougher issues that you find couples presenting that provide kind of a unique challenge and maybe a little more gritty in the work itself?
Yeah. Infidelity is really hard.
Yeah.
You know, a betrayal, a major betrayal. It doesn't just have to be like cheating on your partner. Like, I've actually worked with couples that both have had childhood trauma, but no relational betrayal in their present relationship. And that has seemed to be a little bit, and this is anecdotally speaking, this is just me, easier than those big betrayals, you know, and I get it. And we have lots of success. You know, the betrayal is over. It's safe. There's motivation. There's willingness. There's openness. We have lots and lots of success, but it takes a while.
Yes, it does.
Well, even if like, let's say one partner just kind of wishes that they could get over it. Like, they actually don't even want to think about it. Well, your brain just doesn't work that way. You know, your body doesn't work that way. You're going to be in a protective mode, even if your partner is really present and remorseful and doing the work. There's just this, it's like a very primal amygdala thing that happens. So I would say, I think that's probably one of the most tougher ones. Active addiction. It's really, really hard. You know, you can't really get that deeper work until you have sobriety or safety. I think they're synonymous. You can't really ask couples to be that vulnerable when there's active addiction, you know, because the next relapse, then it's like, it feels actually harmful to have gone that deep.
Yeah.
So you kind of have to do, we call it stage one, but the sort of de-escalating the cycle, kind of providing stability, you kind of just have to stay there until there's sobriety. And, you know, in some cases it's a contraindicator. It's not appropriate to even do couples work, but it's on a spectrum.
Right. Well, what you're talking about here is, despite some of the difficult issues being presented in therapy, there really is some great hope in both individual therapy, but uniquely in couples therapy as well, where they're working to deepen an understanding of themselves and deepen an understanding of kind of themselves in relationship with an intimate other. Give a word out to those that are going through relational challenges right now that are resulting in them maybe feeling, you know, hopeless and just truly despairing, maybe ready to give up and throw in the towel. Send a word their way.
Yeah. So what I would want to say to you is, we have a very clear map, and there are years and years, decades of research that support not just outcome, but interventions along the way. And so if you want it, just from a statistical standpoint,
yes,
and you're both willing to engage in a process, chances are you're not going to be stuck anymore, whatever that means as far as movement, but you really don't have to be in the same place. You know, you may either choose to divorce your relationship and not each other, or move on and be done. But no matter what, you're going to get out of a place of being stuck, and it's going to come from an honest and vulnerable place. You know, so you won't carry things on to the next relationship.
Yeah, it's a good message of hope. And I would agree that there are some great changes that can occur and growth that can happen with honesty and vulnerability and trying to lean, like you're saying, lean into this in a very intentional way with somebody who can kind of shepherd and guide and navigate that process the way you're talking about you're being able to do. You know, as I mentioned, just shifting gears just a wee bit here, as I mentioned at the beginning of our show, you are hearing impaired. Explain to us what this means to you and how that impacts your work, and also give a word to those listeners who may be like you.
Yeah, so it's funny. What it means to me, that's evolving. I'm pretty severely hearing impaired. If without my hearing aids, I wouldn't be able to do this podcast. And I heavily rely on lip reading, so I'm grateful that we're doing this over Zoom.
Yes.
I can see your face and read your lips. I really used to hide this part of myself for a long time. And that was part of my adaptive strategy, right? Mm-hmm. That's how I became successful, is I could just function, but I had to do a bit of an override to do that. And really, since doing this work and kind of learning, I think most therapists can understand that when they engage in a process with clients, you kind of have to go there yourself. Mm-hmm. And so I've really gone to those places and I've learned that this is not a part of me to hide, that this is the part to embrace and actually be explicit about. And it really is my superpower. You know, EFT is all about micro expressions. Well, who better to notice micro expressions than somebody who relies on it just to have a normal conversation? And so I pick up on things really, really quickly because that's how I had to engage in relationship, period. So, you know, I really have learned to embrace it and use it, but I've also learned I actually do have limitations. I get listening fatigue, you know, more than the average person. Mm-hmm. And so that means that I really am careful about my boundaries around my work, how much I do on Zoom. You know, my family knows, you know, that when I come home, I might not be that talkative, right? But I can hug. And yes. So, you know, just knowing your limitations and advocating for yourself.
Really
so being out in the world with masks, I've had to say, it has been good. I've had to say, okay, I'm hearing impaired. I rely on lip reading. I realize you can't take your mask off. I'm not going to take my mask off, but you might have to speak a little louder, look at me in the eyes. Of course, people are wonderful about that.
Yeah, that's a great message to those that might be experiencing something similar in that self-advocacy encouragement. And I trust that most people, once they know, are going to be positive and responsive in the way you're describing. Well, Kelly, I know we're kind of coming into the home lap here. And before we wind down, I've had a great time with you today, but I'd love you to share with us maybe some resources that folks could pursue. We're also going to put these up on our site, but give us some links to you, to your practice, the intensives. We'd love to be able to to have our listeners kind of go to those and review those with you.
Yeah, thank you. So Red, as in the color, redtherapygroup.com is my group practice. And actually on my site, there is a resource tab. And so, you know, you might be a couple that is not ready for couples counseling. There's lots of other entryways into improving your relationship that aren't necessarily therapy. So the resource tab on that site is pretty comprehensive. And then if you're interested in intensives, we have a separate site called EFTmarriageintensive.com. And that includes just about everything you would need to know about what to expect, you know, what to do after you book between now and the intensive, testimonials, all kinds of stuff. So yeah. And then, you know, on my group practice page and the resources, there's a wonderful resource, Hold Me Tight Online. And let's say you're not quite ready for therapy, but you want something a little more than reading a book. Hold Me Tight Online, Sue Johnson had developed this. So it's just a resource for you and your partner to kind of go through. It's like EFT light.
Yes. You know? Okay, good. Very good. Well, I appreciate those resources. Again, we'll have those up on our site as well for you listeners to go through and check out. Kelly, I've so enjoyed our time today. Thank you for being with us and for what you shared regarding your work and this approach. It's been really great. So thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. I've enjoyed it as well.
It's been great to have you here. And to you, our listeners, we really appreciate you being with us as well. Thanks for joining in our show, and we'll look forward to having you back with us next time on Behavioral Health Today.
We appreciate all the support from our community. And if you like our show, one of the best ways you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving a review. Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Tribe Network, all rights reserved.